Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by liberal Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky of Illinois and conservative commentator Bruno Barron from the Heartland Institute. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications on Chicago's fashionable Near North Side, the offices of the institution. And we welcome your phone calls, 1-800-723-8289. That's toll-free. If you'd like to email us a comment, btb@museum.tv. And if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, www.beyondthebeltway.com. We have lots to talk about. There's been a lot of developments in the world of politics with Indiana Governor Mitch Daniels taking himself out of the 2012 race for President of the United States or the Republican nomination. There's been a lot of flap over the controversial comments made last week by Newt Gingrich. It's been sort of a tough week for Newt Gingrich. Congressman Ryan of Wisconsin was on Meet the Press today, opening the door just ever so slightly to possibly being available for maybe a draft, but obviously someone also dominating the news. But again, we begin tonight by talking about the statements involving President Obama and his statements about Israel. It has created quite a stir. Just this afternoon, he addressed AIPAC, which is the leading lobbying organization for Israeli causes. This was after many Jewish leaders, both in Israel and in the United States, were very upset about some recent comments. Jan Schakowsky joins us. She is a longtime guest on this program. In fact, sat in with our good friend Don Wade this past week in his morning show on our flagship station. But again, a longtime friend of this program. And Jan, you are one of the most progressive Democrats I know. You're one of the strongest supporters of Barack Obama. You were a co-chair of his national campaign, and you are also a very proud Jew.
That's right.
Tell us your personal view of what the president suggested this past week, and does it concern you in any way?
You know, I was just driving down here and listening to another channel where they said, and Barack Obama said that there ought to be a peace agreement and a two-state solution based on the 67 borders. That is not what he said, and I'm going to quote him. "We believe the borders of Israel and Palestine should be based on the 1967 lines with mutually agreed swaps, so that secure and recognized borders are established for both states." This is historically the position of the United States. This is not unlike what George W. Bush, what Bill Clinton as president said, what Hillary Clinton said in 2009, and what Ehud Barak, the minister in Israel itself and former prime minister, said 1 month ago. He talked about starting with 67 borders.
Bruno Barron is our conservative this evening. Your reaction to that interpretation, and is that your interpretation of what the president said this week?
Well, clearly you have to take what you see in the press and the actual specific text. Based on what I've looked at, I think the congressman is correct that this is not a radical departure from anything that has been U.S. policy, and I think all of us who have been kind of following the Middle East, we understand that a two-state solution of some sort is the policy and should be the proper policy. I just think it's funny that Barack Obama, who is supposed to have these vaunted communication skills, seems to be able to restate two or three or four different presidents' policies and do it in a way that he gets himself into trouble. But other than that, I tend to think that the analysis that the congresswoman has used is probably accurate.
Well, let me say, I think part of that is a reflection that there is not the kind of trust afforded to Barack Obama for reasons that I don't quite understand, because this president has actually done more for Israel, more appropriations for Israel, the Iron Dome missile defense system. And in fact, the ambassador to the United States. Michael Oren at one point said that this is the most friendly in terms of the policies of this administration.
So how did it get so misinterpreted so quickly and spread so fast?
I do think that there are those who want to jump on Barack Obama. And frankly, the Jewish Republican Committee, whatever they call themselves, was right on it, misstating what he had said. Let me just read for your listeners what Ehud Barak said, former prime minister, current Israeli defense minister. He said, a permanent border set according to security and demography concerns in a manner in which settlement blocks and neighborhoods in Jerusalem remained under Israeli sovereignty and land exchanges that will leave in the hands of the Palestinian territory similar to that which was their land before 1967. So it's not as if the words 1967 in those lines have not been repeatedly uttered by Israeli and American and others around
so
the world.
So Netanyahu overreacted.
I think so. Maybe by now. You know, there's a major conference of AIPAC, which is a pro-Israel organization that's meeting 10,000 people in right now. And
you have the speech earlier today.
Right. And Barack Obama spoke, apparently got a very warm welcome and response to his speech. I am hoping by the time that the Prime Minister Netanyahu speaks to the joint session of Congress, which is going to happen this week, and hopefully the Jewish members will get to meet with him, that maybe this will be smoothed over. I hope it will. Because I know Barack Obama is as staunch a friend of Israel as we're going to find.
Bruno.
Well, there's a whole – you have to look at this also, what's going on in a wider context. Israel right now seems to be worried and probably appropriately so as far as what's going to be happening in Egypt, who's going to be running things or what's going on in Libya. You're looking at a churning of the entire Middle East, and then right before Netanyahu is going to be negotiating an agreement or something, you all of a sudden have the President of the United States come in with a statement which could seem to be setting the stage for negotiations before the two primary parties, the Palestinians and the Israelis, engage in their own negotiations. So I think a lot of this reaction – and look, let's be clear. This is politics. And there's a presidential season coming up, and every single thing everybody does is going to be viewed as a blunder and a mistake.
But there's a lot of people in this country. We hear from them frequently every time we talk about this issue. I'm sure we'll hear from them tonight. They think that the United States is too pro-Israel. They think we bend over backwards, that we're not fair enough to the Palestinians. And it seems to me that part of the message is just this – it's this ticking, I hate to use the word time bomb, but it's this demographic, the realities of the demographic in the area, especially in the wake of what's happening on the Arab street in country after country. I mean, Israel has to wake up to the new reality of the politics in their backyard. And the question is, does a shot across the bow, real or perceived, does that help the cause? Does that get the attention of the Israeli lobby? It certainly did with whatever he said, whether he said it, whether he meant it, whether he was misinterpreted. I mean, it's dominated news for the last, 3 days in the country and also around the world. I want to get your reaction to that. We've also got callers coming in, 1-800-723-8029. Back shortly from Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont. From Texarkana, Texas, to Seattle, Washington, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. We're going to get back to our discussion, take calls in just a moment. But I do want to take a personal time out at this particular program for those people who listen to this program every Sunday night on our flagship station, WLS Radio, and also who watch us on our television version, which plays in Chicago. You all know that the name Tom Roser is synonymous with the discussion of political politics in the United States and certainly in the Chicagoland area. And Tom Roser, who follows us every Sunday night on our flagship station, announced last week that he is retiring. So he has done his final broadcast, and I know perhaps he's listening to this show this evening. And I know I speak for literally hundreds of thousands of conservatives all over the Chicagoland area, maybe into the millions if you're listening around the country. because for the last over 30 years, Tom Roser has been one of the most outspoken and articulate supporters of conservative political causes. Again, he's done the show for many, many years following our Sunday night broadcast. And again, I am very pleased that many, many years ago, back in 1974, when I was just starting out on the radio, that's when I first met Tom Roser. Tom Roser was a frequent guest on a show that I did on a 1,000-watt radio station up in Evanston, Illinois, as was our guest tonight, Jan Schakowsky. And they were opposite sides of the political spectrum. Jan was a local community organizer at that time. Tom was talking about national politics. And again, Tom Roser and I became very, very good friends. And in 1980, in June of 1980, when this program began under the title of Inside Politics, Tom Roser was that very first guest. Tom Roser was on every single week. And so Tom Roser and I became good friends for over 17 years, a regular guest on this program until he branched out and began his own career as a broadcaster on WLS. And again, I'm very proud that it was a long time ago that an opportunity, a guest, it's happened frequently in my life that someone who I invite to be on this program becomes a friend of mine. There's no stronger friend of mine than Tom Roser. I'm sorry to see that he is ending his career. I wish he and his family and Lillian's lovely wife, Lillian, the very best. But again, my hat's off. And again, if you've ever cheered Tom Roser on the radio, as well, he deserves to be cheered. And I know, Jan, you have some comments because although politically you've been on the opposite side, you have been a sparring partner with him on this program and other programs for
well,
over 20 years.
That's what I wanted to say, Bruce, that it's not just conservatives that certainly wish him well and have enjoyed a friendship with him. And on behalf of myself and my husband, Bob, I wanted to wish Tom the very, very best.
And Bruno, you grew up listening and watching Tom Roser.
I grew up listening to Tom Roser when at my first stint at the Heartland Institute in the late 80s was when I had a first chance to meet him personally. I've been on his show a couple times, worked with him on various different issues and causes, and Tom is just one of the greatest Illinois conservatives out there. It's a If Tom had had more of a say in things, Illinois would be in better shape.
And also we should mention again, Tom also was a man of great faith and obviously a historian of the Catholic Church and very strong on his religious beliefs as well. So if you are a fan of Tom Roser, you may already know this because the WLS website has an opportunity for people to offer their farewell greetings and best wishes to Tom Roser for a terrific career as a broadcaster and perhaps one of the most articulate spokesmen for conservative Republican thinking in the United States. And again, Tom, we'll miss you on the air, but we look forward to our next lunch. And now we have callers on the line. Let's go to Cheryl, listening to us in Evanston, Illinois on WLS.
Hi, good evening. I've enjoyed Tom Roser's programs also. He did a great job. Anyway, according to what I heard on the other night on the McLaughlin Group, someone said when Obama was first running for president, he said that he would never ask Israel to give up any of its land under any circumstance, and would the United States give away New Mexico if Mexico insisted. So he's changed his policy on the giving up part of its land thing now that he wants to be the first president to make a peace agreement there.
Well, actually, this is the policy of the State of Israel, the clearly stated policy of Bibi Netanyahu as well as other prime ministers, that any kind of long-lasting peace agreement for the sake of Israel, for the security of Israel, I say that, as you mentioned, as a proud Jew, as someone who views myself very connected to the community, that it's for Israel's sake that a two-state solution will provide the security, the long-lasting security for the people of Israel. So this is not something that any president of the United States made up. This is something that the State of Israel and all of its leaders agree is going to have to be negotiated.
It makes it harder to defend itself,
okay,
according to what Netanyahu said.
Well, Cheryl, the problem is that it's easy for American politicians running for president to make promises that they're trying to get for votes, and they can say a lot of different things. But the fact is that this is a Palestinian and Israeli issue. I think if there's anything that might be rubbing Netanyahu the wrong way in this is, again, if he's doing this and all of a sudden this speech comes up just prior to negotiations, and it's kind of like, hey, I would have liked to have been the person at the negotiating table who was trading things and log rolling and looking for this, that, and the other thing. And to some degree, maybe it's just the wording, maybe it's the political reaction, but at some level it sounds like Barack Obama might have undermined Benjamin Netanyahu's negotiating position here. And I think that's what some of the reaction might be.
Could be. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Let's go to Robert in Naperville on WLS. Coast to coast. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to ask both panelists, if you'd be so kind, how many countries in history have given up land after being attacked on a regular basis and given back the land that they won in those disputes after being attacked? I need your wisdom historically on how many countries have done that.
Bruno?
It's a tough question. I mean, you're looking at a very, very unique situation, however. I mean, Israel is an island of democracy in a sea of what up until a few months ago and what may be again dictatorships. It is a Jewish state in the middle of an Islamic region, and there are just certain things that are going to have to be done, I think, to come to any kind of a peace, if indeed such a thing is even possible. And I think there's a lot of Americans that wonder. They look at the situation and they say, "Is peace even possible in a situation like this?"
Well, the other thing is, I exactly hear what you're saying. That why should Israel have to give up even 1 inch of land after it was attacked and then captured, won the war, and has that land? The problem is that if we want the next generation of Israeli kids that grow up there to be able to live in peace, to be able to not be in a constant state of war, the hope is. That a peace can be negotiated that will be permanent, that will make Israel more secure. And that's why the leaders of Israel have made the decision that that's going to be the solution, a two-state solution.
Okay, thank you very much for your call. Jan, for those listening around the country, we should mention that you are a member of the House Intelligence Committee. You have been on the committee for 5 years.
That's right.
And a couple of weeks ago, you saw the photos of Osama bin Laden, and you agreed with the White House that they should not have been released. Why?
You know, only members of the Intelligence Committee and the Armed Services Committee were invited to go out to Langley, the CIA headquarters, and, you know, you go into a room and sit at a table, and they have a binder of 15 pictures of Osama bin Laden alive and dead. And there's several that are side by side, so it's the same angle. And it's pretty clear. The dead Osama can still be, I think pretty accurately, at least from a layperson's point of view and from the experts as well, that it's him. And what I saw is something that I saw right away. If it went viral on the internet, this is the kind of thing that could inflame people. Not that it's so different from anybody that would be dead in that situation, but right. That it would be used as a recruiting tool for extremists who wanted terrorists who would want to harm us. I just can't see any positive reason for this to be widely circulated. You can just see those pictures, pretty gory pictures, on posters and you know, planning done around that to avenge this.
Do you agree with that decision, Bruno?
Quite frankly, I do. I mean, you're going to have to get into Medicare and Medicaid and Paul Ryan and the election to get me into an argument with Jan on things we don't agree on. Fact of the matter is, I don't like seeing dead people. I don't think it's proper for a nation that holds itself out as the first democracy that wants to have a constitutional form of government and peace to run around parading heads on spikes. Let the Romans do that. That's not our job. I have no interest in seeing them. And sometimes I think, and again, people can have different views on this. I mean, there may be a, people have a right to know free press, free media issue on this. But a lot of the times, the arguments that we get in are simply partisan. It's like, well, Barack Obama said we're not going to be able to see the pictures. I don't like Barack Obama, therefore let's slam him on that one.
You know, I was told the chairman of the Intelligence Committee, who was former FBI, said even families don't get to see crime scene pictures often. So it's not something you parade around for any reason, really.
Exactly.
1-800-723-8029. When we come back, we will talk about the aforementioned Paul Ryan. Back shortly. From Youngstown, Ohio to Houston, Texas, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. 1-800-723-8029 is the telephone number. Joining us this evening is Jan Schakowsky. Jan Schakowsky is the Chief Deputy Whip of the U.S. House. She is in her 13th year in Washington, D.C. As I mentioned, she is a member of the House Intelligence Committee for the last 5 years. And also joining us this evening is Bruno Berend. He is the director of the Center for School Reform for the Heartland Institute. And he's also an attorney and has been a talk show host in his career. And we're going to switch gears now and switch to issues of politics, and specifically Paul Ryan, what he had to say on Meet the Press today, and also this brouhaha between he and Newt Gingrich. And I do want to ask you a question, Jan, because I know you know Paul Ryan, and I want to find. Well, first of all, what type of guy is he? Obviously, you disagree with his politics, but do you know him well, or what's the relationship?
Paul is a very congenial person. Paul, on a personal level, is a really nice guy. And so it's sort of this veneer of niceness, which is real, over a very not nice position on Medicare and many other budget issues.
Do you believe that he could be coaxed into running for president?
You know, with about almost 80% of Americans thinking that the Medicare proposal is a bad idea, that don't want cuts in Medicare, I think that he would not be an ideal person for the Republican Party. We saw
I'd
the
like to see him run then.
Well, I'm answering as more of a pundit tonight. I think he's an attractive person. So is that there's that to balance the other. But I think that his proposals, I think, are going to be soundly rejected. In fact, he may bring back the gavel to the Democrats.
Bruno,
yep.
Would you like to see Paul Ryan as the standard bearer of the Republican Party?
On the presidential level, no. And this is coming from someone who has a great deal of respect for Paul Ryan and thinks that it's absolutely fantastic that someone finally has the courage to challenge a misguided 80%, 20% population on an unsustainable Medicare policy. So I'm and Medicaid and Medicare. So I agree with Paul Ryan on what he's trying to do. But the fact is, he's doing a fantastic job in the House promoting really good ideas. And at the same time, with Mitch Daniels now having decided to get out of the race, I think the regular everyday Republicans who are looking at people out there can look at the field and they can see two relatively sound, very, very good record Republican governors in Tim Pawlenty and Mitt Romney. And I would be one of those people. I'll just out myself right now and say I hope they pick Tim Pawlenty.
Do you believe that Newt Gingrich hurt himself irreparably with his comments last week on Meet the Press, referring to as right-wing social engineering?
Absolutely he did. And again, this comes from someone who has a great deal of respect for Newt and his intellect and what he knows and everything. The fact of the matter is he was way behind the eight ball just with personal baggage and all kinds of other stuff before he said those things. And then he had what I think most politicians would say was the week from hell.
Can I ask a question?
No.
Okay. Was this a blunder or was this just a complete misunderstanding of how his remarks would be received within the party. He misspeak?
Yes, I think he did misspeak. I think he was trying to triangulate. I think he was trying to sit there and say, well, there's a little bit of worry about this policy, and I might be able to slide into the middle here. And I think in typical Newt fashion, he was winging it. And I think he was off message. I don't think there's anything remotely rational about calling a entitlement reform or transformation, whether you agree with it or disagree with it, calling it right-wing
social engineering.
Which was picked up by the Democrats immediately.
Yeah,
because they were quoting their favorite Republican at the moment, Newt Gingrich.
Exactly.
Right?
So I would say it was just Newt going off
because that's not an off-the-cuff kind of description. You know, this is sort of a phrase it seems as if you work over to try and prepare to let it fly on
Then it was a huge blunder.
I think the plan here, I think Newt's, you know, strategy, if you will, was that the first thing that he feels he has to do is he has to address some of the social issues insofar as the social issues of his own house.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to address that baggage, which now, you know, is a significant problem in politics, given what's happening to Arnold Schwarzenegger. Then you also have, he wants to send the word out to the media. He wants to try to finesse them a little bit that he's not the old right-wing flamethrower. He's trying to erase his image with, you know, that the pundits of the world. And I think he sees a way to do that is I've got to take a pot shot at the hot kid in town or the hot idea in town, and that will make me more beloved by maybe the more moderate element of the Republican Party. But what I don't think he realized is how popular, and whether it's 80% or not, Jan, how popular Ryan is with many rank-and-file conservatives.
In other words, winning a primary election, which is what he wanted to do.
Right.
Or wants to, still wants. I guess he's not given up the ghost yet, but I think it is a ghost.
Yeah, because I think that's what happened. I think he gambled, and then when he saw it in print and it kept playing over and over again, I mean it dominated the political news until
right.
Mitch Daniels' announcement last evening. But I don't know whether you saw, on Meet the Press today, this was a clip of Newt campaigning in Iowa.
Right.
In which this voter comes up and just says, you know, I don't appreciate what you did for to Paul Ryan, and he said, well, he started back away. He said, no, you know, that's exactly what you meant. I mean, that was one of the most devastating encounters between a voter and a candidate that I've ever seen. I mean, I'm going to see that
right.
thing 1,500 more times, I'm sure, in a commercial.
Yeah, it was actually more damaging than the actual Meet the Press gaffe.
Yes.
To see the YouTube over and over again of a voter doing that to a guy, and you just see the politician kind of shrink.
I could see him being
the other thing. I don't know if you saw Bob Schieffer today. I heard him on the radio. That's Face the Nation,
yeah,
right?
Sure, right.
Was saying, how is it that you have between $250,000 and $500,000 owed to Tiffany's?
Yeah.
And he kept saying, well, that's private, it's, you know, my, and it's a revolving account or something. But Bob Schieffer, I think, really speaking for a lot of people, was like, what did you buy? You know, I mean, normal people don't, whether they owe it or not, have $250,000 to $500,000 worth of goodies from Tiffany's.
And it's been due for 7 years.
He says, I don't know if it's paid for or not. Well, actually, that's what he said. I don't know if it's paid for, but it's a revolving account. You know, so those kinds of things that put you out.
Just on a revolving account of $500,000. Is that fiscal wisdom?
Well, it all depends on whether you get the high-powered politician's free ride.
He said it was no interest.
He said it was no. I mean, how does he get a $500,000
no-interest
loan?
That's what he said.
How about that?
My wife would love me to forget to get a $500,000 no-interest loan from Tiffany's. But I
got a little bobble for you.
Exactly.
Wife, yeah.
But I just don't – it was just a hell week for him. And I don't think he could have won the nomination before this week, and I think after this week, I don't think there's any way for him ever to win.
We have not had a pro-Tim Pawlenty person on this program, at least identified as such. What makes Tim Pawlenty your candidate?
Unbelievably good fiscal record in a blue state. He was, unlike Mitch Daniels, who was another excellent governor, Tim Pawlenty was elected in a blue state. He was very, very tough on fiscal policy, and then he gets reelected in a blue state. I've seen Tim Pawlenty speak. I swear all these Republicans and all these people who want to reanimate Ronald Reagan's corpse because they need somebody with charisma just don't get it. Pawlenty has plenty of charisma. He's a smart guy. And here's the other thing. He's unbelievably likable, very, very hard to run a Democratic negative campaign against. I mean, and to be sure.
But not real charismatic.
I think there's various kinds of charisma. Is there a Ronald Reagan charisma? Is there a Barack Obama charisma? I think there is, and maybe Tim Pawlenty doesn't have that. But when you listen to him talk and you see him speak from his heart about the things that he wants to get done, I think there's plenty of charisma to get elected president there.
Is Herman Cain a real candidate, or is he a gimmick?
At the risk of Americans don't elect talk show hosts who used to be pizza magnates, who don't know what right of return means, when asked about Israel. And I like Herman Cain. The Republicans have an embarrassment of riches here. They have these really, really decent.
And then they
people.
Just have some embarrassments.
Exactly. But the fact is, folks, Tim Pawlenty is going to be a fantastic candidate. He doesn't have Romney care hanging over him. He's going to be a great president if he makes it through.
I cannot let this conversation end without asking you about Michelle Bachmann. You deal with her.
Well, Michelle Bachmann is now on the Intelligence Committee. I see her. Again, you know, it's sort of a surreal universe I live in Washington, right? You know, within the House of Representatives. On a personal level, I see Michelle at the women's gym. I certainly see her in the Intelligence Committee. And on that level, we get along just fine. But talk about gaffes. I mean, we have seen just incredible things that she has said. You know, she needs a little history lesson about where the shot heard around the world was first fired, not in New Hampshire, but rather in Massachusetts. You know, there.
Does she have the intelligence to be the president of the United States?
Well, I don't know what you mean by intelligence. You know, I don't. I think she's a lawyer. She would be a disaster as president of the United States. I do.
Okay. That doesn't surprise me that you would say
yeah.
that. 1-800-723-8289 if you want to weigh in our discussions. And when we come back, we'll talk more about the specifics of Paul Ryan. Not about his political career, but what is it about his plan that some people think will destroy America. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. We'll go to calls in just a moment. But longtime listeners of this program know that I've been spending a long, long time waiting to complete the new Museum of Broadcast Communications in downtown Chicago. And thanks to some support from the state of Illinois, we were able to restart construction last September. And I'm happy to report that all core and shell construction on the new museum is now completed.
Yay!
In fact, the show that you are watching and listening to tonight is our last broadcast at our current offices. And immediately after the program this evening, I've got my sleeves all rolled up. I'm going to be packing up the set with our colleagues and the members of our crew here, because we're going to be coming to you live from the new Museum of Broadcast Communications next Sunday night.
Fantastic.
And we're also having a big party. We're having a sneak preview open house of the new Museum of Broadcast Communications. And that's going to be on Thursday night, June 16th, from 6 to 9 p.m. It is a benefit. Tickets are $150. If you want to come, everybody is welcome. You go to order the tickets online at museum.tv. You're going to be able to wander through the entire four floors of the museum. And again, it's a long time coming. And certainly there's a lot of people that we want to thank, including obviously the taxpayers of the state of Illinois. And this is an opportunity to see what we've done. And again, the dream is not totally completed yet, because the doors are not open permanently. But again, they will be open on June 16th. And again, we think you will enjoy it if you're able to stop by and see. And then
thanks to
Jan for your help over the years.
You're welcome. I mean, you did that, though, Bruce. And it's such a tremendous legacy that you're giving to the city of Chicago and the world, really. Because I know a lot of things would have absolutely disappeared, would not be available to people, that you've made possible. And you You struggled through it, and you've done it. Congratulations. Okay.
Thank you very much. I do appreciate your comments. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Sally, listening to us in Chicago on WLS.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Sally.
Hello.
Yes.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
We're all
yes.
here.
Okay. First of all, I want to say that congratulations on the museum. I was a contributor.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I've been listening to your show for a long time. I consider myself an independent, and I lean Democratic. And I like Paul Ryan's plan. The problem is, it's 10 years too late. I mean, everybody's in a hurt now, especially senior citizens. You know, 10 years ago when the economy was going, we had money. I don't think it would have bothered us, you know, his plan.
Well, Bella, you know, Sally, I think Paul Ryan would absolutely agree with that. He said it all but today.
I think that one of the biggest mistakes this country has made is during the Clinton boom and even the mini Bush boom, and you could go all the way back to the Reagan boom, we had chances and chances and chances to fix these entitlement programs that every single rational person knew was unsustainable, and instead we kicked the can down the road and engaged in a lot of angry partisan politics over it, when the fact of the matter is that taken together, Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security are unsustainable through the next 20 or 30 years in their current condition.
Jan.
Well, that is just the big lie that has been perpetrated on the American people. Here's where I will agree. Yes, we need to make some changes and bring down the costs of health care in a sensible way, not just Medicare and Medicaid. And the new Affordable Care Act does that in a lot of ways. But I'm wondering if Sally thinks it's a great idea to say to older Americans that no longer will there be a guaranteed health insurance plan that has been paid for, that you've helped pay for through all of your working years. And now we're going to give you a set amount of money and tell you to go out and buy private insurance. Now, you understand the Ryan plan does nothing to control the premiums or the cost of the private plan. So in a way, this is a subsidy being put in the hands of the seniors to give to the insurance companies. And if the amount of money they get doesn't cover the cost of their health care, it comes out of the pockets of seniors. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that by 2020, that will double the out-of-pocket costs for beneficiaries, people over 65 and the disabled, and will add another $6,000 on average for each and every older and disabled American on Medicare. Is that the country we live in? Is that what we want?
Bruno.
That is a one angle of one scenario. The fact of the matter is that I think all of us understand that there's a wide range of wealth in every single cohort, whether it's the 20 to 25 or the 30 to 35 or the people who are 50 and older. And taking these entitlements and means testing them and saying, here is a voucher that you can use and use it as best you can, two things. Number one, all of those things are means tested, and the idea that someone who's really indigent or who can't find the care isn't going to be under some other kind of program, we know how these things get negotiated, and we know that there are safety nets. The other thing is...
Wait, let me pick up on that one point, on the income, okay?
Okay.
Because the median income for people 65 years and older is $19,000.
And
that's the median
and
income.
Let's take their median income, and then let's also look at their net worth and how much they own in their home and how much their retirement income is, or how much of an annuity or how much other subsidies they have. As a class of people, the elderly are actually dollar for dollar doing okay right now. And I'm not saying everybody is. I'm just saying that there are ways to make this system work. Medicare Part D was modeled after this, and it worked. It is. There's a lot of seniors angry because the Obamacare is taking away part of their Medicare Part D that actually worked.
Oh.
Bruno Berend is here. He is with the Heartland Institute. Jan Schakowsky is here. She is the Chief Deputy Whip of the U.S. House, one of the leading voices of Democratic politics. We should mention, by the way, that health care has been Jan's pet topic for about 30 years, even when she was in the Illinois House. So she's not a Janie-come-lately to this issue. This is her political passion. I'm Bruce Dumont. For those listening to us on radio, we'll be back in a few moments. And for those watching us on television, we'll see you next week. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky and conservative commentator Bruno Behrendt from the Heartland Institute, our program coming to you from the home base of the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. And also, if you'd like to join us on the World Wide Web, it's www.beyondthebeltway.com. And if you want to send us an email, it's btb@museum.tv. And I guess, first of all, technically, there is no such thing as a congresswoman. Is that correct?
I think there is.
I thought that was not, that there was no such thing as a congresswoman.
Well, everybody calls me that. Am I not official?
There are female congressmen. I thought there's an official legal thing about that.
Oh, maybe there is, but people call women.
Well, that's why I was confused myself.
No, it's either way I answer.
It looks like a congresswoman. U.S. House of Representatives. I want to begin and kind of broaden the discussion of what we talked about earlier this evening, and that is whether or not when you're dealing with a hot-button issue like Medicare and the budget. Let's focus on the budget. Mm-hmm. And each side has said over the last several months, we need an adult conversation with the American people. And then in the next breath, they will throw some rhetorical grenade against the opposition party and then say, well, you know, we've got to get away from this type of rhetorical bomb throwing. So my question to you is, as someone who lives inside the beltway of Congress, can we have a real serious discussion of solving issues like at least what Paul Ryan says he wants to do? Can we have a discussion like that in a political climate?
You know, I think it might be possible with John Boehner when the discussion first came up about raising the debt ceiling, which most other countries just do automatically. He said that we should have an adult moment. He said, I underline adult, and he was clearly speaking to some of the new people in the new Republicans, mostly the Tea Partiers. Mm-hmm. And then I guess they kind of jumped all over him, flattened him out, and he came back and said something entirely different. So I think that it's hard. It is very hard. Adult conversation is so patronizing in a way. I mean, the kind of conversation where there's actually give and take is very hard right now in the Congress. It just is.
Bruno, you have been a grenade thrower from the outside from time to time in your career.
From time to time. I mean, I guess for whatever reason here in Illinois Republican circles, perhaps because I don't think the party leadership is very effective, but I'm not really that much of a bomb thrower. I mean, I like to tell people the truth, and sometimes telling people the truth is throwing a bomb. There is not enough future tax dollars in the United States of America to pay for all of the pensions, all of the Medicare, all of the Medicaid, all of the Social Security if we want to remain a competitive economy. Now, that doesn't mean that we have to throw grandma off the cliff, which is horrible.
Which is what the Ryan plan does.
It does. No. Jan, what it does is it changes the dynamic of how we're going to finance and spend inside whatever kind of a welfare state. So part of an adult conversation is, yes, the way things are going to have to change, or we're going to say, is there a way? Is there a way to finance this system the way it exists? And the only way to finance it, is through higher taxes at a time when every other economy is becoming more competitive than ours relatively.
Let me talk about taxes, because right now 81% of the American people, when you ask them what is the best way to lower the debt and the deficit, say we should be taxing millionaires and billionaires. Now the truth of the matter is they are the top earners who made whose income jumped, the CEO incomes jumped 20-some percent last year, and corporations that aren't paying any taxes saw their best year last year. And Paul Ryan's plan would lower taxes for those people. This is the time when people are paying lower taxes now than they have for the last 50 years, and the wealth is going to the richest Americans.
But there are experts who I have heard in the last several weeks on television who basically have said is if you taxed the rich to the max, if you taxed them to the match, exactly what you want them to do, it still wouldn't have a significant change on the budget and on the deficit problems.
I actually have a plan that over 10 years would raise about just under $1 trillion dollars if we raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans. Is that $4 trillion? No. It's a quarter of the way there. And we can do a lot of other things. And I had an alternative budget
myself.
Like what? I'm going to introduce...
What's something that gives pain to the middle class or the poor? Do you have anything that gives pain to the middle class?
Now you tell me. I know that we're not on television right now.
Well, yes, we are.
But are we? Okay, I'm just gonna hold this up for people who are.
We
who,
are on
who
TV
can
for
actually,
some people.
Who,
well, those
who
people
can actually
out in radio
say,
land,
here,
we're not.
But here's the deal: between 1976-79 and 2005, income for the top 0.1%, just the increase, was about $6 million. For the bottom 20% of Americans, it was their income over that period went up $200, and for the bottom 80%, their income rose a grand total of $10,000. Now you tell me, are these people in the richest people 6 million times more worthy than people? No, we have seen a hollowing out of the middle class. It is not an accident, and we have seen poor people getting poorer. Many economists now talk about a barbell society where you have rich people on one end, not so many, and a lot. The income, and the average income for 90% of Americans is about $33,000.
And all of that occurred during a time when we created all kinds of benefits and loopholes and everything for some very wealthy people, while at the same time creating all kinds of increases in benefits for the poor and the lower middle class, while we gave the middle class, at least in terms of income tax, a complete free ride. The Reagan tax cuts, the Clinton tax cuts, and the Bush tax cuts.
A free ride for the middle class?
They all took a huge number of people off of the income tax rolls, and those are people on those rolls that are never going to be voting for income tax increases again. Where it all leads to, Jan, and this is what really gets me, we've played out the string on income taxes. Here's what happens.
That is so wrong.
California and the United States of America, we've seen these boom and bust cycles where the economy turns around a little bit. All of a sudden, they're flush with cash, and we're closing the gap and all this other stuff. Same with California. The minute the economy slows down, revenues crash. It is an unsustainable tax system. All the things that Jan wants to fund can't be done with taxing the rich. There's just not enough rich, and there's not enough money. And when you tax them, the money's going to disappear before they pay it.
Our phone number is 1-800-723-8029, taking America's political pulse tonight on the Ryan budget plan. And we've got lots of callers on the line. We will bring them in, and I promise we'll have calls wall to wall the rest of the way.
Okay.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Carbondale, where Don is listening to us tonight on the Internet. Go ahead, Don.
Yes, good evening. I waited 6 years to ask the Congresswoman this question that concerned her stance on Social Security when she excoriated President Bush about wanting people to be allowed to be a bit outside the Social Security system. During her 8 years in the General Assembly, she paid not a penny into Social Security. I'm wondering, is there any Democrat who has the nerve, I could say something else there, to put forth a bill to require all who should be required to pay in Social Security? I think most people that are outside the system are what I call constituents and wards of the Democratic Party. If it's so important, why isn't everybody required to pay into it?
You know, I don't disagree. I actually think it would be.
Then why haven't you done anything?
I have. You have your facts all wrong. I have paid into Social Security. I continue to pay into Social Security.
You paid nothing while you were into the working on your wages that you earned in the General Assembly. You're a hypocrite about that. I've never seen a bill come out of any Democrat requiring everybody to pay into it.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'm not actually. I thought I was paying into Social Security in the state legislature. I do have
You thought you were.
But state employees do not, right?
Yeah, so not all state employees, but I think about 80% of state employees.
State
I'm not sure about
the teachers do not.
The teachers do not. Let me just say, I don't want to fight with you about that, because I think it would be a good idea for more people, if not all people, to pay into Social Security. I do as a member of Congress, and fortunately, we also get a pension, as a lot of people used to do, but private pensions or public pensions are disappearing.
Let's go to Dean in Chicago. Go ahead. You're on WLS and Coast to Coast.
Good evening, Bruce. Excellent show.
Thank you.
As Mitch McConnell said today on Fox News, Social Security, as it exists right now, is not going to be around in 8 years. Now, it's either going to be fixed one way, which is what along the lines of what Congressman Ryan is proposing, or you're going to go to a rationing panel, which is what's in Obamacare. And that's just a simple fact. The money's not there, and if it runs out, you're going to have not time that you've got now to look at it and fix it, you're going to have a debt crisis along the lines of what Greece is having. And at our scale, the Chinese are going to decide how Medicare is going to be fixed. And they're going to be doing it more along the lines of a rationing panel than they ever would along the lines of what Congressman Ryan is proposing. And I'm 60 years old, and I can tell you, everybody knows this is not going to last.
Everybody doesn't know that. And actually, Social Security right now in the trust fund has over $2.7 trillion that's going to go
up. There's no separate trust fund.
There's no trust fund.
It's one big pot of money, and it's been used that way for decades.
If you don't think there's a trust fund, then there
is. What's in the trust fund? I mean, when I think of a trust fund, there's capital in the trust fund, and you withdraw from the trust fund. What have they got in there? IOUs. You've got the Federal Reserve.
Let's let Jan respond.
To buy the government's debt.
Okay, when you put your money into the bank, do you think they put it in a lockbox and that money?
No, there's no lockbox.
And no, when you put your money into the bank, do you think that money is sitting in a pile somewhere? Is that your vision of that? That is what the trust fund is. The money will be there because it is owed to the American people. The money is there in the trust fund, $2.7 trillion going up to $4 trillion.
There's no cash flow. Congressman, there's no cash flow that's going to fund this. There's none. It's running out.
Until 2037, there will be the cash flow.
Dean, the right answer here is there is a trust fund. It is a drawer full of IOUs.
Exactly.
And before those IOUs can be paid, people have to be taxed. So Social Security was supposed to have a net positive inflow up until 2018, and we just saw this year in 2011 and 2012, for the first time, because of the crash in revenues based on the...
It is not the first time.
It is the first time I know of in my lifetime that it's gone negative.
Well, it isn't the first time in your lifetime.
And the fact is that Dean's right. It's an unsustainable system. The question is, do we wait till it crashes into a wall and then everybody's in trouble like we just had with the economic crisis here? Or do we find a way to fix it? There's a very easy way to fix Social Security. And quite frankly, it makes it somewhat viable. Do a couple of slight reforms on the edges. But if you phase in a raised retirement age to 72, it becomes so much closer to viable, and you can't even have that conversation on the Hill.
And here's why. First of all, it could be easily fixed. And I agree with the caller that before we get to 2037, well before, we ought to come up with a plan. People pay into the Social Security Trust Fund only on the first $106,000 of their income. So whether you make $106 million or $106,000, you don't contribute any more to the Social Security Trust Fund. So we could easily fix it. by lifting the cap or raising the cap. That is one way. But let me on raising the age of retirement. Do you know that not everyone is living longer? Poor women have actually lost years in longevity. They are not living as long.
As an African-American, the African-American community has the same problem, which is why Social Security is such a bad investment for them. Here's the thing. If as conservatives and Paul Ryan and John Boehner, if they're supposed to negotiate with Democrats on ways to reform the system and they're supposed to put lifting the cap on the table – and the Democrats just say nothing else is on the table, no raising retirement age, no means testing, no this, no that. This is what we're
talking
about.
And you say no raising of the taxes, no paying more.
Me personally, I think
no paying any more into Social Security.
I think people should get together and put everything on the table. But when that means everything on the table, it doesn't mean another one of those games where Republicans have to give everything, tax increases, all this other stuff, and the Democrats get something that is gone in the next election because it isn't structural reform.
Well, how about
all three programs need structural reform?
Well,
let's do it.
Well, how about this? When it was put before, there's an organization, bipartisan, that went around the country and invited Americans in of all ages, races, sit down at the table and come up with the best ways to solve the Social Security problem. Guess what they came up with? Raising the cap. That is what most people think is fair.
And all those same polls worded in different ways and having different conversations.
No, they sat down with numbers.
I could do a focus group as you could do a focus group, and we could lead the people where we want to lead them. I'm 50. I have no problem with my Social Security retirement age being raised to 72, and most people my age probably feel pretty much the same. So why don't we do a line where it's 50 or 55, and if it's 55 or older, you get the existing system, and if it's 55 or younger, you get to have an option to have a privatized or a personal account system and a different structure. It's simple.
Earlier in the broadcast, you talked about that, I guess a recent poll suggested that 80% of the people didn't like the Ryan plan, or they didn't like the specifics
Medicare.
Of the Ryan Medicare plan, the Medicare aspect of the Ryan budget plan. Ryan said on Meet the Press today, he said leadership is about changing the polls. Leadership is about saying things and doing things and changing the polls. Isn't that true? Isn't that what lead, whether
what?
It's this
no,
issue
no.
or other
I,
issues?
I mean, you know what? Yes, we should help to lead people to a new place. But the place that we ought to think about is what are our values as a country? When you do budgets, you want to start with what are the things that are most important to us? And then we figure out how are we going to get there. In 1965, finally, the government said, we're not going to let older Americans die without health care, go into, you know, poverty because they can't afford the health care that they need. We're going to establish a program that everybody pays into, and then everybody will be guaranteed health care. What we do in terms of our elderly, people with disabilities, children, poor people who cannot work, that's who we are as a nation. As the president said, we take care of ourselves. That's the American way. And we take care of each other.
But if in taking care of ourselves, we have and politicians on both sides who want to be friends with the folks.
But hear me through. Okay.
If they do that, and as the system grows older and as problems exist in the system, if there's somebody that's out there that says, you know, folks, we can't give you what we have promised you. We can't keep going down this same road. The math was wrong. We made a mistake. Republicans made mistakes. Democrats made mistakes. We spent too much money. We're at a point now that if we don't stop, take a breath, and dramatically change things. Obviously, 80% of the people don't like change.
Let me quickly answer that. In the Affordable Care Act, the Democrats actually managed to reduce the cost of Medicare, not by reducing benefits, but by $500 billion. The Republicans ran campaigns saying the Democrats want to gut Medicare. They want to take your Medicare away. Am I right?
What they did is they looked at Obamacare and they looked at the what you call the Affordable Care Act, and the Affordable Care Act changed incentives across the entire.
No, talk about Medicare. Were there not campaigns run Democrats want to cut your Medicare.
And the reason for that is because if and don't quote me on every single detail of it. You're the congressman. You know more than I do on this specific issue in terms of all the I's dotted and T's crossed. But everything I read about this talked about a shift of resources from elderly to the people who are going to be on the new mandated health care program. And that's what I read into
when I looked at it.
And, Bruce, to your point, and I think you raised it properly, the systems as they've been designed in 1932 with Social Security and 1965 with the health care plan, if they're not working and if they have to be made
they
to work, then you have to come to the table and reform them.
We've got to pause when we come back. 1-800-723-8029. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Jen Schakowsky is here. She has been a member of the, she is the chief deputy whip of the U.S. House. She's in her 13th year in Washington, D.C. She's also on the House Intelligence Committee, has been on that committee for 5 years. Bruno Behrendt also joins us. He is the director of the Center for School Reform at the Heartland Institute. And again, if you have just tuned in this broadcast, let me repeat something that I said a little bit earlier. You perhaps know by now that our good friend and longtime supporter of this program, Tom Roser, has retired from WLS. He follows us every Sunday night. We wish him very well in his future chapters of his life. And again, it's been an honor and pleasure to be his lead-in for many, many years. And also, as you know, if you're longtime listeners in the Chicagoland area, Tom began as a regular on our first show back in 1980, the pro show that preceded this called Inside Politics. He was a regular panelist on that show for over 17 years. And another regular panelist for 8 years on that program was a guy by the name of Rahm Emanuel. And I have to tell you that it's interesting that in 1 week on Monday, I go to the inauguration of Rahm Emanuel being sworn in as mayor of the city of Chicago, and 5 days later, someone that used to engage in verbal combat with him each and every week for over 8 years, Tom Roser, announces that he is retiring from radio. So Tom is one of the great conservative commentators of all time, certainly in this neck of the woods. And Rahm certainly was a phrase maker back in the late 80s when he was a regular guest on this program, and obviously has gone on to great fame and fortune. We wish him well. Jan, I know you were at the inauguration, as was I. And I will tell you, I thought the speech was absolutely incredible. If he can do 50% of what he said he wants to do, he will be, I think, the greatest mayor in the city's history.
I think he's got a good chance. And Rahm is a doer, you know.
Yes,
I mean,
he's
very concrete. This is what we have to do. He's really not much of a speechifier normally. It was a very good speech. Absolutely.
Very good on Monday.
Good speech. But, you know, I imagine I didn't watch the Chicago City, his first city council meeting, but Rahm gets right down to business. And
yeah,
I think it's going to be a good thing for the city of Chicago.
Now, one of the things he talked about during the campaign, by the way, we digress only shortly because one of the things that Rahm Emanuel has spoken a great deal about is education, the importance of education. That is the subject that is near and dear to your heart.
Mm-hmm.
He supports charter schools. I would assume that he's probably saying a lot of things that you like to hear as well.
Rahm actually ran on what we at the Heartland Institute think is a very, very excellent piece of public policy, and it's called the parent trigger. So if your child is attending a failing school, the parents can actually get together and form a petition and get the petition signed, and if more than half of them sign it, they can flip the school into either closure, charter, or some form of transformation and turnaround. And Rahm Emanuel, amazingly enough, ran on that. What's funny about this is that the parent trigger was not a free market think tank idea right out of the box. It was actually run by a bunch of progressives in California who were sick and tired of the corrupt and stonewalling actions of the Los Angeles Unit School District. So now you've got progressives trying to reform schools. We've been noticing this in the education reform movement that Democrats for Education Reform, Hispanic CREO, BAYO, these are the education groups that are from the minority community, and they're finally starting to realize that the existing system isn't functioning for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, in that speech, obviously he talked a great deal about schools. He talked about a great deal about crime, about reducing the crime rate, which is horrendous in certain sections of Chicago. And again, I think he really, I thought, lowered the boom on parental responsibility, something that whether you're liberal or conservative, you should understand is that it is the most important door that a child walks through is the door at home. And I thought he made that point, and I thought he made it the most articulate.
I think those were exactly his words.
Yes.
I have very, very mixed feelings about the idea of a parent trigger where parents can vote to shut down the school. I mean, I think, you know, for the vast majority of the 400,000 kids in the Chicago public schools, I think we need to invest in those schools. We have to embrace the teachers. And they actually in Springfield came to agreement with the Chicago teacher, with mm-hmm. the State Teachers Union.
Rahm described it as one of the most significant pieces of legislation.
Exactly. But let me just say about the parents. I mean, we do need to figure out ways that we can help to engage parents and provide parents with those opportunities to get involved in the schools.
Well, and one of the hardest, it's not possible to engage or empower parents by not empowering them. You can't give them a pat on the head and say, come to your school board meeting or come to your district meeting and then tell them that they're empowered. And you can't empower parents if they don't have the actual ability to change something that's not working in the school. And more money and more bureaucracy and the slow-moving bureaucracy of 125 South Clark isn't cutting it.
There were some rousing moments of in the speech where the applause was rousing. And then when he got to some of the issues of reform and what the expectations of city workers are, it was a little tepid. Did you notice the difference in the tone of the applause, Jed?
Well, you know, there were some parts liked more than others, but I would say generally that, you know, it was this crystal clear day. Chicago couldn't have looked more beautiful. No. And you look out at the crowd, and it was Chicago. It was very diverse, and Rahm spent time talking about how Chicago is a place that celebrates its diversity.
And
so
I think
it was well received.
The other thing I also think that again, I think there was just an appropriate amount of deference to Mayor Daley and to Maggie on the contributions that they did make and have made to the city, and they have. And yet he did not sugarcoat it in such a way that there are significant issues that have not been resolved, that the city is in worse shape than it was 25 years ago. And he wants to do something about it. And so
Rahm worked for the mayor. There's a lot of mutual respect that goes on there.
They go back
but this
long
is
way.
A very challenging time. I think Rahm is ready to take those on, and he made it very clear that he's going to make some tough decisions.
I'm very proud of his 8 years as a member of this show. And again, the irony of he and Tom Roser, one walking in the door while the other says farewell to his broadcast career, both the graduates of Inside Politics. Again, I wish them both well. And also, by the way, for those listening to us on our flagship station, Jake Hartford will follow us tonight in the Tom Roser slot, and I know he'll have a lot more to say about Tom on his broadcast coming up on WLS in Chicago. Let's go to Valparaiso, Indiana, where Jake is listening to us on WLS. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
Okay.
Good. Hey, listen, I took the panel's comments on David Stockman's editorial and his interviews on NPR with regards to both political parties, the budget, and the Ryan plan. I think David Stockman is basically putting it right on the wire when he says nothing off the table, both on revenues and on cuts. And I think that's the way it needs to be. I don't think that we can just push away defense, take off the top tier folk on anything else, and then just do cuts, 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 without also increasing revenues right across the board, either those in the middle class as well as those in the upper reaches of the income scale. So, I mean, I'd like to see what everybody here has to say about David Stockman and his view.
Bruno.
Well, I think Reagan's first budget director, David Stockman. Well, first of all, he was the guy that actually started to try to tell the truth back in the early 80s, and he was taken to the woodshed and then cashiered because even though Ronald Reagan ran on and probably wanted to cut a lot of spending, the fact of the matter is that he ran into the buzzsaw of American politics, which is this idea that you don't ever really do what you ran on because that's a mistake politically. What we're starting to see now is that the years of tax cuts and taking people off the tax rolls and economic booms built on paper and printed matter are at an end, and I think that he's right. Everything should be on the table, and when I say everything, I mean deep cuts in trade for any kind of revenue streams. But quite frankly, the most important thing is structural change. It can't just be more of the same on structural change of all these programs.
Bonnie in Crown Point, Indiana. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you for taking my call. I'm very upset about something that Congresswoman Schakowsky said. You know, when she mentioned the fact that the Ryan plan is reducing the tax rate of the wealthiest people, you know, Jan, you really should have told the rest of it because they want to reduce the top rate to 25%, which all by itself draws guests around the table. But the rest of the plan is that he wants to eliminate some of these loopholes that the millionaires have. That's why, you know, that's why there's something called an alternative minimum tax, because if there wasn't, due to the loopholes, the credits, the deductions, some of the millionaires would not pay a penny of income taxes. And I would also point out, on a personal matter, her husband Bob has been a guest on some of these shows, and I remember him once saying that there should be more taxes on the wealthy. Well, we all pretty much know that Jan and her husband are not poor people. They are probably not even middle class, and there is no law that says that if he and she really believe that they should pay more taxes, there's no law that says they can't pull out their checkbook, write a check to the U.S. Treasury, write a cover letter and say this is not to fulfill any of my, you know, tax obligations, past, present, or future. I so strongly feel that I need to pay more taxes that I'm sending you this check.
Bonnie, we're going to pause for a break, and when we come back, Jan is going to answer your question, and we'll see if she has her checkbook with her. Back shortly. Bruce Dumont back. Before we continue, a reminder that if you would like to come to the open house, a sneak preview open house of the new Museum of Broadcast Communications at 360 North State, it's coming up on June 16th. From 6 to 9 p.m., tickets are $150. It's a benefit for the museum. You can order the tickets online, museum.tv. There's going to be a lot of activity, a lot of stars, a lot of politicians, a lot of people rubbing shoulders and walking through and seeing what the new museum is going to be all about. Let's go. By the way, Jan, we had a caller, Bonnie from Crown Point, Indiana. She wanted you to dip into your pocketbook and help pay down the national debt.
Yeah, well, actually, first of all, I am willing to pay more taxes if we had a tax system that was different. Although the tax proposal I made starts at $1 million, raising taxes for millionaires and ratcheting up to people who make $1 billion a year. There are Americans who made $1 billion in 1 year and probably pay most of it at a 15% rate as some sort of a capital gain. They're hedge fund managers, et cetera, and I don't think that's right. I'm prepared to pay more, however, but it's not going to reduce the debt.
Bruno?
I don't have a checkbook big enough to write a check for the national debt.
Let's go to Spokane, Washington. KXLY is the station. Mike is the caller. Nice to hear from the Pacific Northwest.
Thank you, Bruce, and thanks for taking my call. You know, the people who live in poverty often have poor health. They cannot afford health care, they have no pension, and have a shorter lifespan.
That's right.
So to raise Social Security to age 72 would, in fact, be a death sentence for these people.
Actually, there's been a study on that low-income people do live shorter. than wealthier people. And you said the reason, because they have less access to health care, often to nutritional food. Food prices, by the way, have gone up so bad, so high, that it's very hard to get the fresh produce that you need. So that's the other group that would really suffer from raising the age.
Well, and as the guy who talked about raising the retirement age to 72, the fact is that there's ways to restructure the Social Security system so that the people who are, no matter what your income range is or how healthy you are, you can actually benefit from the system. I don't understand why there are so many people who are opposed, and they reside mostly in the Democratic Party, why they're opposed to personal accounts. There are ways to keep the system the way it is for many of the people while allowing for personal accounts, and then as maybe at the age of 55 or at the age of 60. Right now we have early retirement for all the public employees at 55 and 60 and 59, and yet you can't get Social Security until you turn 62 or 65. And here's the other thing. For all those people who are a minority or in bad health who might not be able to benefit from it, they're the ones that are hurt most by this system, primarily because the rates of returns are so low. There's a reason teachers and public employees don't pay into Social Security. Bruno, it's a lousy deal.
But, Bruno, if there were private accounts, if some of the Social Security benefit was diverted to a private account in 2008 and when everything went crashed down, mm-hmm. Then what happens? All of their security disappears.
It's an excellent question, and let me address it, because it's one of the best questions that people ask about if you have a private account. And the fact is that there are ways to address that with portfolio security, with portfolio insurance. You can retire so that you're almost entirely in money markets and bonds and not in stocks. And there's already all kinds of financial instruments that set this up for you. So
the whole economy almost collapsed. But if we had private accounts, they'd be all right.
I know people who had all their money in stocks and lost a great deal of it. And I know people who had their money in bonds and money markets and didn't lose anything at all. So the fact is that this is a way to solve a problem. I'm not saying everything should have every dime of their money in a private account. I'm just saying give Americans options and they will make decent decisions.
I think on top of Social Security, that's a good idea, but not instead of.
So we have a basis for work with.
I mentioned that you were the national co-chair of the Obama campaign. Once upon a time in 1992, it was referred to as George Bush and the Seven Dwarfs, referring to all the Democrats that were running. No one of stature was out there that was going to touch George Bush. Right now, people are saying that Barack Obama's got a tough reelection, but you're looking at a wide field. Most of the field, no one seems to be totally enamored by that field as yet. Do you think Obama has a tough reelection effort?
I do think he does, and the reason for that is because this is a tough economy right now. A lot of people are still hurting. A lot of people are still fearing that, and this is something that the Obama campaign is planning for, that people are still feeling quite insecure. When that happens, I think that the political arena becomes very volatile. And so, we're going to be ready for a very tough campaign.
If the economy on a scale of 1 to 10 is 6 or above, it's going to be very hard to beat Barack Obama. If the economy – and this is not real numbers. This is people's perception. If the economy is 4 or below, I think virtually anybody could
–
on a scale of 1 to 10, if it's perceived as 4 or below – Barack Obama is going to have a really hard time getting reelected. And if it's in between 4 and 6, which I think is where it's going to be and where it is now, it's going to be a tough election. I'll pitch one more time, and I'm not on anybody's payroll. I'm not a political consultant anymore. But I think the best chance to beat Barack Obama is nominating Tim Pawlenty.
And one quick question, 10 seconds. If you could have the White House or you could have the United States Senate as a Republican, which would you like best? You could only have one.
I'll take the Senate if we get all the way to 60, which we can.
Bruno Barrett has been our card-carrying libertarian conservative from the Heartland Institute this evening, Jan Schakowsky. Jan, always a pleasure to have
you
on this
Bruno,
program.
Thank you, Bruno. Don't put your money on that.
Okay. By the way, as I mentioned, this is our last broadcast from this location. So as our director, Fritz Goldman, for those watching us on television, pulls back, you'll see our magnificent offices where we do this show each and every week. I've got my sleeves rolled up. We are ready to pack up this place. We'll be back next week live from our new Museum of Broadcast Communications. Tom Veracruz and Dan Dorfman helped make this program possible, as well as Mark Glick. We'll see you next week. All right, let's pull out the microphone.